The Ego and His Own by Max Stirner, continued, Cassette 4, Side 2. In this supreme development of free man, egoism, self-ownership, is combated on principle, and such subordinate ends as the social welfare of the socialists, etc., vanish before the lofty idea of humanity. Everything that is not a general human entity is something separate, satisfies only some or one, or if it satisfies all, it does this to them only as individuals, not as men, and is therefore called egoistic. To the socialists, welfare is still the supreme aim, as free rivalry was the approved thing to the political liberals. Now welfare is free too, and we are free to achieve welfare, just as he who wanted to enter into rivalry, competition, was free to do so. But to take part in the rivalry, you need only to be commoners. To take part in the welfare, only to be laborers. Neither reaches the point of being synonymous with man. It is truly well with man only when he is also intellectually free. For man is mind. Therefore, all powers that are alien to him, the mind, all superhuman, heavenly, unhuman powers, must be overthrown, and the name man must be above every name. So, in this end of the modern age, age of the moderns, there returns again, as the main point, what had been the main point at its beginning, intellectual liberty. To the communist in particular, the humane liberal says, if society prescribes to you your activity, then this is indeed free from the influence of the individual, the egoist. But it still does not, on that account, need to be a purely human activity, nor you to be a complete organ of humanity. What kind of activity society demands of you remains accidental, you know. It might give you a place in building a temple or something of that sort. Or, even if not that, you might yet on your own impulse be active for something foolish, therefore unhuman. Yes, more yet, you really labor only to nourish yourself, in general to live, for dear life's sake, not for the glorification of humanity. Consequently, free activity is not attained till you make yourself free from all stupidities, from everything non-human, namely egoistic, pertaining only to the individual, not to the man in the individual. Dissipate all untrue thoughts that obscure man or the idea of humanity. In short, when you are not merely unhampered in your activity, but the substance too of your activity is only what is human, and you live and work only for humanity. But this is not the case so long as the aim of your effort is only your welfare and that of all. What you do for the society of ragamuffins is not yet anything done for human society. Laboring does not alone make you a man, because it is something formal and its object accidental. The question is who you that labor are. As far as laboring goes, you might do it from an egoistic, material impulse, merely to procure nourishment and the like. It must be a labor furthering humanity, calculated for the good of humanity, serving historical human evolution, in short, a human labor. This implies two things. One, that it be useful to humanity. Next, that it be the work of a man. The first alone may be the case with every labor, as even the labors of nature, as of animals, are utilized by humanity for the furthering of science, etc. The second requires that he who labors should know the human object of his labor, and as he can have this consciousness only when he knows himself as man, the crucial condition is self-consciousness. Unquestionably, much is already attained when you cease to be a fragment laborer, yet therewith you only get a view of the whole of your labor and acquire a consciousness about it, which is still far removed from a self-consciousness, a consciousness about your true self or essence, man with a capital M. The laborer has still remaining the desire for a higher consciousness, which, because the activity of labor is unable to quiet it, he satisfies in a leisure hour. Hence leisure stands by the side of his labor, and he sees himself compelled to proclaim labor and idling human in one breath. Yes, to attribute the true elevation to the idler, the leisure enjoyer. He labors only to get rid of labor. He wants to make labor free, only that he may be free from labor. In fine, his work has no satisfying substance because it is only imposed by society, only a stint, a task, a calling. And conversely, his society does not satisfy because it gives only work. His labor ought to satisfy him as a man. Instead of that, it satisfies society. Society ought to treat him as a man, and it treats him as a ragtag laborer or a laboring ragamuffin. Labor and society are of use to him not as he needs them as a man, but only as he needs them as an egoist. Such is the attitude of criticism toward labor. It points to mind, wages the war of mind with the masses, and pronounces communistic labor unintellectual mass labor. Averse to labor as they are, the masses love to make labor easy for themselves. In literature, which is today furnished in mass, this aversion to labor begets the universally known superficiality, which puts from it the toil of research. Therefore, humane liberalism says, you want labor? All right. We want it likewise. But we want it in the fullest measure. We want it not that we may gain spare time, but that we may find all satisfaction in it itself. We want labor because it is our self-development. But then, the labor too must be adapted to that end. Man is honored only by human, self-conscious labor, only by the labor that has for its end no egoistic purpose but man with a capital M and is man's self-revelation. So that the saying should be, laboro ergo sum, I labor, therefore I am a man. The humane liberal wants that labor of the mind, which works up all material. He wants the mind that leaves no thing quiet or in its existing condition, that acquiesces in nothing, analyzes everything, criticizes anew every result that has been gained. This restless mind is the true laborer. It obliterates prejudices, shatters limits and narrownesses, and raises man above everything that would like to dominate over him. While the communist labors only for himself, and not even freely, but from necessity. In short, represents a man condemned to hard labor. The laborer of such a type is not egoistic because he does not labor for individuals, neither for himself nor for other individuals, not for private men, therefore, but for humanity and its progress. He does not ease individual pains, does not care for individual wants, but removes limits within which humanity is pressed, dispels prejudices which dominate an entire time, vanquishes hindrances that obstruct the path of all, clears away errors in which men entangle themselves, discovers truths which are found through him for all and for all time. In short, he lives and labors for humanity. Now, in the first place, the discoverer of a great truth doubtless knows that it can be useful to the rest of men, and as a jealous withholding furnishes him no enjoyment, he communicates it. But even though he has the consciousness that his communication is highly valuable to the rest, yet he has in no wise sought and found his truth for the sake of the rest, but for his own sake, because he himself desired it, because darkness and fancies left him no rest till he had procured for himself light and enlightenment to the best of his powers. He labors, therefore, for his own sake and for the satisfaction of his want. That along with this he was also useful to others, yes, to posterity, does not take from his labor the egoistic character. In the next place, if he did labor only on his own account, like the rest, why should his act be human, those of the rest unhuman, that is, egoistic? Perhaps because this book, painting, symphony, is the labor of his whole being, because he has done his best in it, has spread himself out wholly and is wholly to be known from it, while the work of a handicraftsman mirrors only the handicraftsman, the skill in handicraft, not the man. In his poems, we have the whole Schiller. In So Many Hundred Stoves, on the other hand, we have before us only the stove maker, not the man. But does this mean more than in the one work you see me as completely as possible, in the other only my skill? Is it not me again that the act expresses? And is it not more egoistic to offer oneself to the world in a book, to work out and shape oneself, than to remain concealed behind one's labor? You say, to be sure, that you are revealing man with a capital M, but the man that you reveal is you. You reveal only yourself, yet with this distinction from the handicraftsman, that he does not understand how to compress himself into one labor, but in order to be known as himself, must be searched out in his other relations of life, and that your want, through whose satisfaction that work came into being, was a theoretical want. But you will reply that you reveal quite another man, a worthier, higher, greater, a man that is more man than that other. I will assume that you accomplish all that is possible to man, that you bring to pass what no other succeeds in. Wherein, then, does your greatness consist? Precisely in this, that you are more than other men, the masses, more than men ordinarily are, more than ordinary men. Precisely in your elevation above men. You are distinguished beyond other men not by being man, but because you are a unique man. Doubtless you show what a man can do, but because you, a man, do it, this by no means shows that others, also men, are able to do as much. You have executed it only as a unique man, and are unique therein. It is not man that makes up your greatness, but you create it because you are more than man, and mightier than other men. It is believed that one cannot be more than man. Rather, one cannot be less. It is believed further that whatever one attains is good for man with a capital M. Insofar as I remain at all times a man, or, like Schiller, a Swabian, like Kant, a Prussian, like Gustavus Adolphus, a nearsighted person, I certainly become by my superior qualities a notable man, Swabian, Prussian, or nearsighted person. But the case is not much better with that than with Frederick the Great's cane, which became famous for Frederick's sake. To give God the glory corresponds the modern give man the glory, but I mean to keep it for myself. Criticism, issuing the summons to man to be human, enunciates the necessary condition of sociability, for only as a man among men is one companionable. Herewith it makes known its social object, the establishment of human society. Among social theories, criticism is indisputably the most complete, because it removes and deprives of value everything that separates man from man, all prerogatives down to the prerogative of faith. In it, the love principle of Christianity, the true social principle, comes to the purest fulfillment, and the last possible experiment is tried to take away exclusiveness and repulsion from men, a fight against egoism in its simplest and therefore hardest form, in the form of singleness, exclusiveness itself. How can you live a truly social life so long as even one exclusiveness still exists between you? I ask, conversely, how can you be truly single so long as even one connection still exists between you? If you are connected, you cannot leave each other. If a tie clasps you, you are something only with another, and 12 of you make a dozen, thousands of you a people, millions of you humanity. Only when you are human can you keep company with each other as men, just as you can understand each other as patriots only when you are patriotic. All right, then I answer, only when you are single can you have intercourse with each other as what you are. It is precisely the keenest critic who is hit hardest by the curse of his principle. Putting from him one exclusive thing after another, shaking off churchliness, patriotism, etc., he undoes one tie after another and separates himself from the churchly man, from the patriot, till at last, when all ties are undone, he stands alone. He, of all men, must exclude all that have anything exclusive or private, and when you get to the bottom, what can be more exclusive than the exclusive, single person himself? Or does he perhaps think that the situation would be better if all became man with a capital M and gave up exclusiveness? Why, for the very reason that all means every individual, the most glaring contradiction is still maintained, for the individual is exclusiveness itself. If the humane liberal no longer concedes to the individual anything private or exclusive, any private thought, any private folly, if he criticizes everything away from him before his face, since his hatred of the private is an absolute and fanatical hatred, if he knows no tolerance toward what is private, because everything private is unhuman, yet he cannot criticize away the private person himself, since the hardness of the individual person resists his criticism, and he must be satisfied with declaring this person a private person and really leaving everything private to him again. What will the society that no longer cares about anything private do? Make the private impossible? No, but subordinate it to the interests of society, and, for example, leave it to private will to institute holidays as many as it chooses, if only it does not come in collision with the general interest. Everything private is left free, That is, it has no interest for society. By their raising barriers against science, the church and religiousness have declared that they are what they always were, only that this was hidden under another semblance when they were proclaimed to be the basis and necessary foundation of the state, a matter of purely private concern. Even when they were connected with the state and made it Christian, they were only the proof that the state had not yet developed its general political idea, that it was only instituting private rights. They were only the highest expression for the fact that the state was a private affair and had to do only with private affairs. When the state shall at last have the courage and strength to fulfill its general destiny and to be free, when, therefore, it is also able to give separate interests and private concerns their true position, then religion and the church will be free as they have never been hitherto. As a matter of the most purely private concern and a satisfaction of purely personal want, they will be left to themselves, and every individual, every congregation and ecclesiastical communion will be able to care for the blessedness of their souls as they choose and as they think necessary. Every one will care for his soul's blessedness as far as it is to him a personal want, and will accept and pay as spiritual caretaker the one who seems to him to offer the best guarantee for the satisfaction of his want. Science is at last left entirely out of the game. What is to happen, though? Is social life to have an end, and all companionableness, all fraternization, everything that is created by the love or society principle to disappear? As if one will not always seek the other because he needs him, as if one must accommodate himself to the other when he needs him. But the difference is this, that then the individual really unites with the individual, while formerly they were bound together by a tie. Son and father are bound together before majority. After it, they can come together independently. Before it, they belonged together as members of the family. After it, they unite as egoists. Sonship and fatherhood remain, but son and father no longer pin themselves down to these. The last privilege, in truth, is man, with a capital M. With it, all are privileged or invested. For, as Bruno Bauer himself says, privilege remains even when it is extended to all. Thus, liberalism runs its course in the following transformations. First, the individual is not man. Therefore, his individual personality is of no account. No personal will, no arbitrariness, no orders or mandates. Second, the individual has nothing human. Therefore, no mine and thine, or property, is valid. Third, as the individual neither is man nor has anything human, he shall not exist at all. He shall, as an egoist with his egoistic belongings, be annihilated by criticism to make room for man with a capital M, man just discovered. But although the individual is not man, man is yet present in the individual, and, like every spook and everything divine, has its existence in him. Hence, political liberalism awards to the individual everything that pertains to him as a man by birth, as a born man, among which there are counted liberty of conscience, the possession of goods, in short, the rights of man. Socialism grants to the individual what pertains to him as an active man, as a laboring man. Finally, humane liberalism gives the individual what he has as a man, that is, everything that belongs to humanity. Accordingly, the single one has nothing at all, humanity everything, and the necessity of the regeneration preached in Christianity is demanded unambiguously and in the completest measure. Become a new creature. Become man. One might even think himself reminded of the close of the Lord's Prayer. To man belongs the lordship, the power or dynamis. Therefore, no individual may be lord, but man is the lord of individuals. Man's is the kingdom, the world. Consequently, the individual is not to be proprietor, but man, all, command the world as property. To man is due renown, glorification, or glory from all. For man, or humanity, is the individual's end, for which he labors, thinks, lives, and for whose glorification he must become man. Hitherto, men have always striven to find out a fellowship in which their inequalities in other respects should become non-essential. They strove for equalization, consequently for equality, and wanted to come all under one hat, which means nothing less than that they were seeking for one Lord, one tie, one faith. 'Tis in one God we all believe. There cannot be for men anything more fellowly or more equal than man with a capital M himself. And in this fellowship the love craving has found its contentment. It did not rest till it had brought on this last equalization, leveled all inequality, laid man on the breast of man. But under this very fellowship decay and ruin become most glaring. In a more limited fellowship, the Frenchman still stood against the German, the Christian against the Mohammedan, and so on. Now, on the contrary, man stands against men, or, as men are not man, man stands against the unman. The sentence, God has become man, is now followed by the other, man has become I. This is the human I. But we invert it and say, I was not able to find myself so long as I sought myself as man, with a capital M. But now that it appears that man is aspiring to become I and to gain a corporeity in me, I note that, after all, everything depends on me, and man is lost without me. But I do not care to give myself up to be the shrine of this most holy thing, and shall not ask henceforward whether I am man or unman in what I set about. Let this spirit keep off my neck. Humane liberalism goes to work radically. If you want to be or have anything especial, even in one point, if you want to retain for yourself even one prerogative above others, to claim even one right that is not a general right of man, you are an egoist. Very good. I do not want to have or be anything especial above others. I do not want to claim any prerogative against them. But I do not measure myself by others either, and do not want to have any right whatever. I want to be all and have all that I can be and have. Whether others are and have anything similar, what do I care? The equal, the same, they can neither be nor have. I cause no detriment to them, as I cause no detriment to the rock, by being ahead of it in having motion. If they could have it, they would have it. To cause other men no detriment is the point of the demand to possess no prerogative. To renounce all being ahead, the strictest theory of renunciation. One is not to count himself as anything especial, such as, for example, a Jew or a Christian. Well, I do not count myself as anything especial, but as unique. Doubtless I have similarity with others, yet that holds good only for comparison or reflection. In fact, I am incomparable, unique. My flesh is not their flesh. My mind is not their mind. If you bring them under the generalities flesh, mind, those are your thoughts, which have nothing to do with my flesh, my mind, and can least of all issue a call to mine. I do not want to recognize or respect in you anything, neither the proprietor, nor the ragamuffin, nor even the man, but to use you. In salt, I find that it makes food palatable to me, therefore I dissolve it. In the fish, I recognize an element, therefore I eat it. In you, I discover the gift of making my life agreeable, therefore I choose you as a companion. Or, in salt, I study crystallization, in the fish, animality, in you, men, etc. But to me, you are only what you are for me, to wit, my object, and because my object, therefore my property. In humane liberalism, ragamuffinhood is completed. We must first come down to the most ragamuffin-like, most poverty-stricken condition if we want to arrive at ownness, for we must strip off everything alien. But nothing seems more ragamuffin-like than naked man. It is more than ragamuffinhood, however, when I throw away man too, because I feel that he too is alien to me, and that I can make no pretensions on that basis. This is no longer mere ragamuffinhood, because even the last rag has fallen off. Here stands real nakedness, denudation of everything alien. The ragamuffin has stripped off ragamuffinhood itself, and therewith has ceased to be what he was, a ragamuffin. I am no longer a ragamuffin, but have been one. Up to this time, the discord could not come to an outbreak, because properly there is current only a contention of modern liberals with antiquated liberals, a contention of those who understand freedom in a small measure and those who want the full measure of freedom, of the moderate and measureless, therefore. Everything turns on the question, how free must man be? That man must be free, in this all believe, therefore all are liberal too. But the unman, who is somewhere in every individual, how is he blocked? how can it be arranged not to leave the unman free at the same time with man? Liberalism as a whole has a deadly enemy, an invincible opposite, as God has the devil. By the side of man stands always the unman, the individual, the egoist. State, society, humanity do not master this devil. Humane liberalism has undertaken the task of showing the other liberals that they still do not want freedom. If the other liberals had before their eyes only isolated egoism and were for the most part blind, radical liberalism has against it egoism in mass, throws among the masses all who do not make the cause of freedom their own as it does, so that now man and unman, rigorously separated, stand over against each other as enemies, to wit, the masses and criticism, namely, free human criticism, as it is called, in opposition to crude, that is, religious criticism. Criticism expresses the hope that it will be victorious over all the masses and give them a general certificate of insolvency. So it means finally to make itself out in the right and to represent all contention of the faint-hearted and timorous as an egoistic stubbornness, as pettiness, paltriness. All wrangling loses significance and petty dissensions are given up because in criticism a common enemy enters the field. You are egoists all together, one no better than another. Now the egoists stand together against criticism. Really the egoists? No. They fight against criticism precisely because it accuses them of egoism. They do not plead guilty of egoism. Accordingly, criticism and the masses stand on the same basis. Both fight against egoism. Both repudiate it for themselves and charge it to each other. Criticism and the masses pursue the same goal, freedom from egoism, and wrangle only over which of them approaches nearest to the goal or even attains it. The Jews, the Christians, the absolutists, the men of darkness and men of light, politicians, communists, all, in short, hold the reproach of egoism far from them. And as criticism brings against them this reproach in plain terms and in the most extended sense, all justify themselves against the accusation of egoism and combat egoism, the same enemy with whom criticism wages war. Both criticism and masses are enemies of egoists, and both seek to liberate themselves from egoism, as well by clearing or whitewashing themselves as by ascribing it to the opposite party. The critic is the true spokesman of the masses, who gives them the simple concept and the phrase of egoism, while the spokesmen to whom the triumph is denied were only bunglers. He is their prince and general in the war against egoism for freedom. What he fights against, they fight against. But at the same time, he is their enemy, too, only not the enemy before them, but the friendly enemy, who wields the knout behind the timorous to force courage into them. Hereby, the opposition of criticism and the masses is reduced to the following contradiction. You are egoists. No, we are not. I will prove it to you. You shall have our justification. Let us, then, take both for what they give themselves out for, non-egoists, and what they take each other for, egoists. They are egoists and are not. Properly, criticism says, you must liberate your ego from all limitedness so entirely that it becomes a human ego. I say, liberate yourself as far as you can, and you have done your part. For it is not given to everyone to break through all limits, or, more expressively, not to everyone is that a limit which is a limit for the rest. Consequently, do not tire yourself with toiling at the limits of others. Enough if you tear down yours. Who has ever succeeded in tearing down even one limit for all men? Are not countless persons today, as at all times, running about with all the limitations of humanity? He who overturns one of his limits may have shown others the way and the means. The overturning of their limits remains their affair. Nobody does anything else either. To demand of people that they become holy men is to call on them to cast down all human limits. That is impossible, because man, with a capital M, has no limits. I have some, indeed, but then it is only mine that concern me any, and only they can be overcome by me. A human ego I cannot become, just because I am I, and not merely man. Yet let us still see whether criticism has not taught us something that we can lay to heart. I am not free if I am not without interests, not man if I am not disinterested. Well, even if it makes little difference to me to be free or man, yet I do not want to leave unused any occasion to realize myself or make myself count. criticism offers me this occasion by the teaching that if anything plants itself firmly in me and becomes indissoluble, I become its prisoner and servant, a possessed man. An interest, be it for what it may, has kidnapped a slave in me if I cannot get away from it and is no longer my property, but I am its. Let us therefore accept criticism's lesson to let no part of our property become stable and to feel comfortable only in dissolving it. So, if criticism says, you are man only when you are restlessly criticizing and dissolving, then we say, man I am without that, and I am I likewise. Therefore, I want only to be careful to secure my property to myself, and in order to secure it, I continually take it back into myself, annihilate in it every movement toward independence, and swallow it before it can fix itself and become a fixed idea or a mania. But I do that not for the sake of my human calling, but because I call myself to it. I do not strut about dissolving everything that it is possible for a man to dissolve, and, for example, while not yet 10 years old, I do not criticize the nonsense of the commandments, but I am man all the same, and act humanly in just this, that I still leave them uncriticized. In short, I have no calling, and follow none, not even that to be a man. Do I now reject what liberalism has won in its various exertions? Far be the day that anything won should be lost. Only after man, with a capital M, has become free through liberalism, I turn my gaze back upon myself and confess to myself openly, what man, with a capital M, seems to have gained, I alone have gained. Man is free when man is to man the supreme being. So it belongs to the completion of liberalism that every other supreme being be annulled, theology overturned by anthropology, God and His grace laughed down, atheism universal. The egoism of property has given up the last that it had to give when even the my God has become senseless. For God exists only when He has at heart the individual's welfare, as the latter seeks his welfare in him. Political liberalism abolished the inequality of masters and servants. It made people masterless, anarchic. The master was now removed from the individual, the egoist, to become a ghost, the law, or the state. Social liberalism abolishes the inequality of possession, of the poor and rich, and makes people possessionless or propertyless. Property is withdrawn from the individual and surrendered to ghostly society. Humane liberalism makes people godless, atheistic. Therefore, the individual's God, my God, must be put an end to. Now, masterlessness is indeed, at the same time, freedom from service. Possessionlessness, at the same time, freedom from care. And godlessness, at the same time, freedom from prejudice. For with the master, the servant falls away. With possession, the care about it. With the firmly rooted God, prejudice. But since the master rises again as state, the servant appears again as subject. Since possession becomes the property of society, care is begotten anew as labor. And since God as man becomes a prejudice, there arises a new faith, faith in humanity or liberty. For the individual's God, the God of all, to wit, man, is now exalted, for it is the highest thing in us all to be man. But as nobody can become entirely what the idea man imports, man remains to the individual a lofty other world, an unattained supreme being, a God. But at the same time, this is the true God, because he is fully adequate to us, to wit, our own self, we ourselves, but separated from us and lifted above us. Postscript. The foregoing review of Free Human Criticism was written by Bitts immediately after the appearance of the books in question, as was also that which elsewhere refers to writings of this tendency, and I did little more than bring together the fragments. But criticism is restlessly pressing forward, and thereby makes it necessary for me to come back to it once more, now that my book is finished, and insert this concluding note. I have before me the latest 8th number of the Allgemeine Literaturzeitung of Bruno Bauer. There again, the general interests of society stand at the top, but criticism has reflected and given this society a specification by which it is discriminated from a form which previously had still been confused with it. The state, in former passages still celebrated as free state, is quite given up because it can in no wise fulfill the task of human society. Criticism only saw itself compelled to identify for a moment human and political affairs in 1842. But now it has found that the state, even as free state, is not human society, or as it could likewise say, that the people is not man. We saw how it got through with theology and showed clearly that God sinks into dust before man. We see it now come to a clearance with politics in the same way and show that before man, peoples and nationalities fall. So we see how it has its explanation with church and state, declaring them both unhuman. And we shall see, for it betrays this to us already, how it can also give proof that before man, the masses, which it even calls a spiritual being, appear worthless. And how should the lesser spiritual beings be able to maintain themselves before the Supreme Spirit? Man casts down the false idols. So what the critic has in view for the present is the scrutiny of the masses, which he will place before man in order to combat them from the standpoint of man. What is now the object of criticism? The masses, a spiritual being. These the critic will learn to know and will find that they are in contradiction with man. He will demonstrate that they are unhuman and will succeed just as well in this demonstration as in the former ones, that the divine and the national, or the concerns of church and of state, were the unhuman. The masses are defined as the most significant product of the revolution, as the deceived multitude which the illusions of political illumination, and in general the entire illumination movement of the 18th century, have given over to boundless disgruntlement. The revolution satisfied some by its result, and left others unsatisfied. The satisfied part is the commonalty, bourgeoisie, etc. The unsatisfied is the masses. Does not the critic, so placed, himself belong to the masses? But the unsatisfied are still in great mistiness, and their discontent utters itself only in a boundless disgruntlement. This the likewise unsatisfied critic now wants to master. He cannot want and attain more than to bring that spiritual being, the masses, out of its disgruntlement, and to uplift those who were only disgruntled, to give them the right attitude toward those results of the revolution which are to be overcome. He can become the head of the masses, their decided spokesman. Therefore, he wants also to abolish the deep chasm which parts him from the multitude. From those who want to uplift the lower classes of the people, he is distinguished by wanting to deliver from disgruntlement not merely these, but himself too. But assuredly, his consciousness does not deceive him either when he takes the masses to be the natural opponents of theory, and foresees that the more this theory shall develop itself, so much the more will it make the masses compact. For the critic cannot enlighten or satisfy the masses with his presupposition, man. If over against the commonalty they are only the lower classes of the people, politically insignificant masses, over against man they must still more be mere masses, humanly insignificant, yes, unhuman masses, or a multitude of unmen. The critic clears away everything human, and starting from the presupposition that the human is the true, he works against himself, denying it wherever it had been hitherto found. He proves only that the human is to be found nowhere except in his head, but the unhuman everywhere. The unhuman is the real, the extant on all hands, and by the proof that it is not human, the critic only enunciates plainly the tautological sentence that it is the unhuman. But what if the unhuman, turning its back on itself with resolute heart, should at the same time turn away from the disturbing critic and leave him standing, untouched and unstung by his remonstrance? You call me the unhuman, it might say to him, and so I really am, for you. But I am so only because you bring me into opposition to the human, and I could despise myself only so long as I let myself be hypnotized into this opposition. I was contemptible because I sought my better self outside me. I was the unhuman because I dreamed of the human. I resembled the pious who hunger for their true self and always remain poor sinners. I thought of myself only in comparison to another. Enough! I was not all in all, was not unique. But now I cease to appear to myself as the unhuman, cease to measure myself and let myself be measured by man, cease to recognize anything above me. Consequently, adieu, humane critic. I only have been the unhuman, am it now no longer, but am the unique. Yes, to your loathing, the egoistic. Yet not the egoistic as it lets itself be measured by the human, humane and unselfish, but the egoistic as the unique. We have to pay attention to still another sentence of the same number. Criticism sets up no dogmas and wants to learn to know nothing but things. The critic is afraid of becoming dogmatic or setting up dogmas, of course. Why, thereby, he would become the opposite of the critic, the dogmatist. He would now become bad, as he is good as critic, or would become, from an unselfish man, an egoist. Of all things, no dogma. This is his dogma. For the critic remains on one and the same ground with the dogmatist, that of thoughts. Like the latter, he always starts from a thought, but varies in this, that he never ceases to keep the principal thought in the process of thinking, and so does not let it become stable. He only asserts the thought process against the thought faith, the progress of thinking against stationariness in it. From criticism, no thought is safe, since criticism is thought, or the thinking mind itself. Therefore, I repeat that the religious world, and this is the world of thought, reaches its completion in criticism, where thinking extends its encroachments over every thought, no one of which may egoistically establish itself. Where would the purity of criticism, the purity of thinking, be left if even one thought escaped the process of thinking? This explains the fact that the critic has even begun already to jibe gently here and there at the thought of man, of humanity and humaneness, because he suspects that here a thought is approaching dogmatic fixity. But yet he cannot decompose this thought till he has found a higher in which it dissolves, for he moves only in thoughts. This higher thought might be enunciated as that of the movement or process of thinking itself, as the thought of thinking or of criticism, for example. Freedom of thinking has in fact become complete hereby. Freedom of mind celebrates its triumph. For the individual, egoistic thoughts have lost their dogmatic truculence. There is nothing left but the dogma of free thinking or of criticism. Against everything that belongs to the world of thought, criticism is in the right, that is, in might. It is the victor. Criticism and criticism alone is up to date. From the standpoint of thought, there is no power capable of being an overmatch for criticisms, and it is a pleasure to see how easily and sportively this dragon swallows all other serpents of thought. Each serpent twists, to be sure, but criticism crushes it in all its turns. I am no opponent of criticism. I am no dogmatist, and do not feel myself touched by the critic's tooth with which he tears the dogmatist to pieces. If I were a dogmatist, I should place at the head a dogma, a thought, an idea, a principle, and should complete this as a systematist, spinning it out to a system, a structure of thought. Conversely, if I were a critic, an opponent of the dogmatist, I should carry on the fight of free thinking against the enthralling thought. I should defend thinking against what was thought. But I am neither the champion of a thought nor the champion of thinking. For I, from whom I start, am not a thought, nor do I consist in thinking. Against me, the unnameable, the realm of thoughts, thinking, and mind is shattered. This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.